All right, let's pick it up on session 27, page 194 in your notebook, and let's do a quick review. Last week, we were looking at the preamble to the 67 war. The preamble was the fact that Syrian artillery on the Golan Heights was constantly bombarding the Hula Valley and the Israeli farmers in the Hulayat Valley. And here's a picture from the floor of the Hula Valley looking at the Golan Heights. And just imagine there's guns up on that ridgeline firing down at you. That became insufferable. Many incursions by the Syrians, and I believe it was Fatah, inflicted many casualties. The Russians then tried to get involved in this thing, and they told the Egyptians that Israel was massing for a surprise attack on Damascus. Nasser sent an investigatory team to Syria. They didn't see any Israeli military buildup, but Nasser decided to go ahead and up the ante anyway. He sent his armored columns into the Sinai Peninsula. He demanded that the UNEF leave, which the UNEF did, and all of a sudden he had a free rein to go against Israel. The other nations, other Arab nations around him joined in the party. So the green arrows there are the Egyptian advance across the Sinai. Then as we start from the east side of Israel, moving up, the Saudi Arabians moved the military in. The Jordanians, the red arrow, moved their military in. The Iraqi army crossed from Iraq through Jordan and moved their forces in. Up in Syria, the Syrian army moved to the Golan Heights, etc. And Lebanon moved to the northern border. So the armies of Israel's enemies amassed on Israel's border. This is the first, in a covenant, by the way. Remember, this is an agreement. They're all covenanting together. And that's what we saw in Psalm 83, that the enemies of Israel would covenant together for her destruction. This is the first time it has ever happened in Israel's history. There's no record in the Bible of this happening before. All the nations surrounding her covenanting against her. And as we looked at Psalm 83, the modern Jordanians covered the area of Edom, Lot, Moab, and Ammon in verses 6, 7, and 8. The modern nation of Saudi Arabia represented the Ishmaelites in verse 6. The modern Egyptians represented the Hagarites in verse 6, because the early Egyptians were descendants of Hagar. The Lebanese represented the mention of Gabel and Tyre in verse 7. Amalek is represented by the Bedouins of verse 7. The Gaza Strip represents those, the Arabs in the Gaza Strip represented Philistia, because the Gaza Strip basically is the Philistine plain there. And Syria and Iraq represented Assyria in verse 8. So Psalm 83 is being fulfilled before our eyes as we watch. Israel responded with a preemptive strike against the 19 airfields in Egypt. They all hit the Egyptian airfields at 7:45 a.m., turned Nasser's Air Force into dust, 320 out of 340 airplanes destroyed in just a few minutes. A half hour later, the Israeli armor started into the Suez, and this is the initial crossing of the border, hitting the Arab armor that had crossed into the Suez. They destroyed the armor, and then over the next few days, crossed the entire Suez right up to the Suez Canal. So in 4 days, they reached the canal. Then our attention turned to the Battle of Jerusalem. The Battle of Jerusalem began when the Jordanians took Government House. Here's the old city. Government House is to the south on the slopes of the Hill of Evil Counsel. The Jordanians took Government House here, and after they took Government House, they began to shell Mount Scopus, the Israeli demilitarized zone, housing Hadassah Hospital. And so the Israelis said, we've got to stop this attack. So the first step was to get the Hill of Evil Council in this area and Government House. So two Israeli squads then captured Government House and the Hill of Evil Council. That area was secured. The next step was to take the high point at Ammunition Hill, located in approximately this area. So paratroopers cross no man's land and attack the trenches on Ammunition Hill for a very bloody, brutal and but successful conquest of that high point. The next stage was to attack the Mandelbaum Gate. Another of the paratroopers, another squad or brigade, whatever, of the paratroopers took the Mandelbaum Gate. They continued through the Mandelbaum Gate and secured the area to the east of the hill of Ammunition Hill. So this area was now secured. At that time, as well, in the West Bank, Israeli forces were involved in a pincer movement, taking the West Bank and the tanks even moving down to the Jordan River. So the West Bank was taken. The paratroopers then moved to the Augusta Victoria Church, and this area was now secured. With that area secured, down the hill, down the road of the Mount of Olives and to the Lion's Gate of the Old City. And one of the major entrances to the Old City, the Lion's Gate, through the Lion's Gate, and a quick left turn, and they took the Temple Mount, out the Mughrabi Gate, and then down the Mughrabi, here's the Israeli paratroopers taking the Temple Mount. Ice cream. I hear ice cream. Whose phone is that? No, it's been the back. It's on the back left of that. Is that Pam?
No, it's my dog.
Yours is off. All right. Well,
somebody else.
Okay. I will let them worry about bringing the ice cream next week. All right. Here's the paratroopers taking the Temple Mount. And then out of the Mughrabi Gate, and here is the prayer alley where Jewish people had been allowed to pray for some 2,000 years. And again, taken by the paratroopers, and the very famous picture of the paratroopers at the Western Wall. The generals soon followed. And that brings us now to the conquest of the Golan Heights. We need to turn our attention north to the Golan Heights on page 194. The Northern War, the last segment of the war. Everybody there? The final decision awaiting the government was the action regarding Syria. At 3 a.m. on June 9th, Diane was informed that the Egyptian and Jordanian ceasefires had come into effect. So the southern and eastern fronts were now quiet. At this point, he decided to move against the northern front, the northern enemy, that's the Syrian front. Israel's strategy was to crack the main fortifications, move into the roads behind the Syrians, and the enemy will panic. And their strategy was exactly correct. It proved correct. The morale of the Syrian army was shattered irretrievably, and its troops began fleeing for their lives. At 5:30 p.m. on June 9th, the Syrian representative in the Security Council announced that his government had ordered an end to the fighting in compliance with the UN ceasefire resolution. Within a half hour, similar orders had gone out to the Israeli armed forces on the northern front. However, Israel maintained their drive with the intention of taking the entire Golan. At the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv, tension was growing as the Golan offensive raced the UN ceasefire deadline. The Israeli drive was successful, and the entire Golan Heights was taken. And here you can see a map of the Golan Heights. The light area is the area that Israel took from Syria during the Six-Day War. That is the Golan Heights overlooking the Hula Valley and the Sea of Galilee. Now, the Six-Day War ended officially at 6:30 p.m. Israel time, June 10th. It had been a catastrophic defeat for the Syrians. In 27 hours of battle, just a little over one day, they lost 2,500 killed, 5,000 wounded, one-third of their tanks, half their military, 80,000 soldiers and civilians fleeing the Golan. Israel lost 115 killed, 306 wounded, two civilians killed, 16 wounded, and that was from the Syrian bombardment of the Galilee settlements. The entire Golan Plateau was now in Israel's hands, and the long nightmare of the Syrian bombardment was over. The nation's equipment losses were 40 planes and 80 tanks. The Arabs may have suffered up to 300,000 casualties. This is for the whole war. 30,000. Excuse me, I got an extra zero in there, didn't I? 30,000 casualties, at least 450 planes and 1,000 tanks destroyed or captured, as well as vast quantities of supplementary equipment. All right, so you have this map on page 145. It's a summary of the Northern War on the Golan Heights. So you can look that up in detail. Here's some pictures of the Golan Heights, so you get a view of the area that is being attacked. This is the Golan Heights looking east. This is probably from Mount Avital. You can see there's a lot of farms there. Where the farms end is where the DMZ begins. And off in the distance, this is the town of Kunetria. You hear a lot about Kunetria in the news today, don't you? Because there's a fighting raging there between the rebels and the Assad regime. And that's the town of Kunetria. It's right on the edge of the DMZ. Now, I cranked my camera up to full telephoto to try to get you some kind of a view of Kunetria. So there you can see that Arab town way off in the distance. You notice there's no farmland because that's the DMZ there. Nobody's allowed in that area except maybe UN troops. Now, we turn our eye north, and this is the Golan Heights. From about the middle of the Golan Heights looking north, the mountain to the north is Mount Hermon. And that's Lake Ra. You can see all the Israeli farms in the foreground. So the Israelis have really developed the Golan Heights. And this is not so pretty a sign. You see these signs all over the place up there because the Syrians literally put down thousands upon thousands of landmines up there. Most of them have not been cleared out. So if you're up on the Golan Heights and you see this sign on a barbed wire fence, don't go any further, okay? Believe them. There are landmines there, left over from the Syrian occupation of the Golan Heights. So that's what you'll see today. Okay, that's page 195. Let's move on to page 196, the results. Results of the Six-Day War. A new military geographic reality had been created in the Middle East. Now here is a map of the territory after the Six-Day War. Israel, of course, is the light-colored, yellowish country in the middle there, and then the light brown is the Sinai Peninsula, now occupied by Israel, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. And notice the Straits of Tiran are no longer barricaded. So that is the reality after the Six-Day War, the new geographic military reality. Now, if you're interested in a more detailed look at the Six-Day War, there is a documentary done by WGBH Boston. It's a video called 6 Days in June. I think it's an hour and a half long. The war that redefined the Middle East. So if you're interested in picking that up, you might be able to find it on YouTube or something. I don't know. But you can pick it up on Amazon.com if you're interested in it. It'll be a more detailed look at the Six-Day War. Okay, I see pencils flashing. So I'm going to let you copy down the title, 6 Days in June, WGBH Boston. Okay, everybody got that wants it? So there's another resource for you to take a look at the Six-Day War. Okay, before the war, the main Israeli population centers had lain within 4 minutes flying time of the nearest Arab airbase. 4 minutes, you guys. An Arab land offense into Israel, except in the southern Negev, would have affected thickly inhabited areas. Much of Israel's narrow wasteland had fallen within Arab artillery range, as had Jewish Jerusalem and the northern Galilee settlements. But now after the war, the situation was reversed. It was the Israeli planes and troops that were within close striking distance of Amman, that's Amman, Jordan, Damascus, that's Syria, Cairo, that's Egypt. Jewish Jerusalem was no longer on the firing line, nor was the Galilee, nor any other Israeli population center. Howard Sachar explains the incredible change from a purely human perspective, and I have that quote for you in the middle of page 196. What accounted for the earthquake? The explanation hardly could be attributed to superiority of weapons. The equipment advantages was entirely the Arabs. Rather, as in the earlier Arab-Israeli wars, the decisive factor was the human element. The literacy gap between Arab and Israeli common soldier was one facet in the equation. Leadership was another. The Egyptian staff officers were guilty of astonishing overconfidence and lack of organization. The force of personal example was vital as well. At almost every echelon, Arab staff and operations officers panicked once the Jews achieved their initial breakthroughs. In the end, however, it was more than literacy and commitment that tipped the balance in Israel's favor. It was the courage of desperation at all levels. Well, all that Howard Sakhar mentioned here is undoubtedly true, but it is not enough. It doesn't really explain the whole picture. It's not satisfactory to me. In the end, there's more to be said. In the end, we have to acknowledge the hand of God poised over the nation of Israel. Human courage alone cannot explain the Six-Day War. Only when we acknowledge the unseen activity of divine intervention can we satisfactorily account for all that happened. All right. Page 198. UN Security Council Resolution 242 is also one of the results of the Six-Day War. On June 9th, the Communist Bloc leaders gathered in Moscow, where seven of them issued a long declaration of solidarity with the Arab cause, promising to help the Arab nations should Israel continue its aggression. Within the next few days, all the communist governments, except for Romania, severed relations with Israel. Bickering and belligerent incidents continued, and the UN tried to hammer out an acceptable diplomatic formula for all sides. The result, on November 22, 1967, was UN Resolution 242. UN Resolution 242 contains three important provisions in regard to Israel and her neighbors. Number one, the Arab states are required to recognize the existence of the state of Israel and make peace. Has that happened?
No.
Only in the case of Egypt and Jordan. That's all. Two, Israel's security needs are acknowledged. Any peace agreement with the Arabs must include secure and recognized boundaries that Israel can withdraw behind. These boundaries need not be the same as the lines drawn in the armistice agreements of 1949. Third, Israel can occupy and administer the territories that were conquered during the state of war. The occupation and administration can continue until peace agreements are recognized. Resolution 242 does not require that Israel return to a state of military insecurity. Arthur J. Goldberg, the American ambassador who led the delegation to the UN in 1967, submitted on May 8, 1973, an authoritative interpretation of the meaning of Resolution 242. He explained that the resolution is not self-implementing, and that its goal is an accepted and agreed-upon settlement. Goldberg rejected the interpretation that the resolution calls for a complete Israeli withdrawal. He wrote, and this quote is in the bottom of page 198, Resolution 242 does not explicitly require that Israel withdraw to the lines occupied by it before the outbreak of the war. The Arab states urge such language. The Soviet Union proposed this at the Security Council, and Yugoslavia and some other nations at the special session of the General Assembly. But such withdrawal language did not receive the requisite support either in the Security Council or in the Assembly. That's the General Assembly. Resolution 242 simply endorses the principle of withdrawal of Israel's armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict and interrelates this with the principle that every state in the area is entitled to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries. So Resolution 242 has really never been implemented at all. Okay, so that's the results of the Six-Day War from a human perspective. Now, what are the results from a more biblical perspective? And now, you'd have to find a spot to write this down. This isn't in your notes. You do have about an inch at the bottom of page 198. Two results I see from a biblical perspective. Number one is that God empowered Israel enabling her to survive another mortal threat. So that's a result I think we can support from biblical statements. God empowered Israel, enabling her to survive another mortal threat. But secondly, again from a biblical perspective, God was also moving in Jewish lives by bringing many Jewish people to faith in Yeshua during this time. It's quite amazing, you guys. God was also moving in Jewish lives by bringing many Jewish people to faith in Yeshua during this time. Many of us in ministry today came to faith during this general time frame. Yeah, you'll talk with people of my generation. Yeah, I came to faith just right after the Six-Day War, right during the Six-Day War, or whatever. So God was at work in the nation Israel. All right, did you guys get that? Okay, one more time. The second result was God was bringing many Jewish people to faith in Yeshua during this time frame. During this time frame. I came to faith right around 1967 myself. Although I was in basic training when the Six-Day War happened, I wasn't even aware of it. I was isolated in basic training. All right, at this point, I want to emphasize the fact that we can't explain the Six-Day War simply in human terms, as Howard Sachar has done. We've got to acknowledge that God's hand was empowering Israel to survive another mortal threat. And we get a little look at that in Program 7 of Against All Odds. 1967 is the title of Program 7. So I'm going to let you guys take your break, take a 15-minute break. And when you get back, we'll have Program 7 ready to go. It'll be about a 30-minute program. We'll see God intervene in the lives of Israelis who were part of the Six-Day War. All right, so go ahead and take your break.